How do you feel about AI generated content? And do you feel that if it comes back from your tool that it's 100% AI generated within that certainty, do you think that's riskier or it doesn't matter? Okay, everyone, welcome back to the SEO Entrepreneur Show. I have John Gillum on the podcast. So I'm super excited about this one because he is the founder of Originality.ai. And, you know, however you feel about the tool, that doesn't really matter. I think it's an awesome tool, and I think he has a lot to share. A lot of people don't actually really know John's background. He has a very, very extensive background in building, you know, actually building real businesses online and driving them with SEO. But most importantly, he's been on the cutting edge of this AI movement. So we're going to be getting deep into that. So thank you so much for coming on, John.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me, and yeah, excited to chat about it. And yeah, glad to hear you're doing this podcast, and excited to listen to the episodes.
Yeah, for sure. So just for, you know, people that may not know your background, just a real quick, you know, kind of cliff notes of, you know, where you started and where you are today.
Yeah, sure. So originally engineer by training, mechanical, and then sort of had a day job, wanted to get out of that, built up a portfolio of websites. And then off the back of that portfolio of websites, launched some services that sort of like took what I was doing and systematized it with my businesses. And then built some service businesses, a content agency, a link building agency, all sort of off the back of sort of the content site first was sort of my portfolio that sort of led to me being able to leave the day job in sort of 2015. And then since then have launched a couple different projects, all sort of generally around producing content, having the content rank in Google and the sort of the business of doing that. So I've had a few different businesses since. But yeah, sort of everything has been always sort of content that ranks in Google has been the majority of sort of the central theme of the majority of my projects.
Right. Yeah. I remember actually reading your blog many, many years ago, probably 2015-ish, 2014, okay. when you would share the case studies and about everything you were working on. So you rebranded. So what was the original name of the domain?
So very similar. Authority Website Income just changed it to Website Income.
Okay, got it. Yeah. And so at that time, you were pretty much just focused on building niche sites, correct? Content-driven sites. Okay.
Yeah.
And how were you monetizing those sites?
Display ads, affiliate offerings, the majority, and then got into some. I flipped a few into e-commerce businesses.
Okay.
Happy when I've done those because those have sort of stuck around and had the most longevity compared to some of the pure content sites that didn't stick around for as long. But yeah, that was at that time display ads and affiliate.
Okay. And so you're definitely more on the side of like the pure content play when it comes to SEO. Do you do link acquisition? How do you feel about that?
Yeah. I mean, one of my first businesses that was sort of like, was the building of like PBNs back in the day. You know, anyone that says links don't work are wrong. I mean, it definitely works. Like, of course it works. Everyone knows it works. It's just a question of, you know, the risk and the cost and the risk and the balancing of that equation. So some of the projects we are actively acquiring links. A lot of projects we don't.
Yeah. So you, since you started, so when did you actually start? Was this like 2012, 2013 in that range or even earlier?
I'd say first sort of like discover, like if I go way back to how I got into it, it was like a summer co-op at a sort of robotic startup company. And they're like, okay. Hey, you're the co-op. We need a website. And this was like, I'm like, I don't know how to do that. I'm Upwork. And like, it was Odesk at the time. And I was like, that was like one of those like moments of like, holy crap, you can do this. So it was actually kind of like 2008, 2009 timing. Okay. when I first started building some sites.
Yeah. So the reason I asked is just because I'm always want to talk to people who've been through many cycles.
Yeah.
And so obviously if you started back then, you've been through Panda, you've been through Penguin, you've been through the EMD update, you've been through all of these updates. So how has your SEO strategy evolved over time? And I'm sure, you know, I know I got hit on a few of those updates. So, and it made me learn, made me not make a lot of the same mistakes. But so how have things evolved for you over time?
Yeah, I think, especially in the first few years, it was just like, it was just a game. It was like, play a computer game or do some SEO. And that, you know, they were kind of interchangeable. And so I wasn't taking it too serious until we found out that we, you know, having children and really wanted to get back to our hometown. And so I'd say like the first years was just learning and playing. The evolution has always been towards adding higher value. I think that's been the central theme is like, in the end, the best content, the best website, the you know, page that answers the searcher's query the best will win. And it has been sort of a gradual trend towards that direction with some aggressive kicks in the ass from Google on reminding you that, yeah, cool, you found a hack, but that's not necessarily going to last forever.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think this is a good transition into that the biggest, let's call it, hack right now, which is AI content, right? So,
yep.
So obviously I want to hear really about the origin story of Originally.ai and how you know, clearly one thing I've noticed about your portfolio, a lot of things you do try to jump on kind of market trends, I've noticed. So maybe before I said, let's talk about, you know, your ventures into, let's say, crypto and what you learned from that experience.
Sure. Yeah. Always eager to sort of identify new opportunities. You know, definitely have the bright shiny object syndrome that I think a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with. I've sort of decided to just embrace it. And when we sort of see an opportunity where we think we can add value, we do. Sometimes we're right, sometimes we're wrong. In the case of the crypto project, it was, you know, it's a really murky world between the advertiser that's buying the ads and us, the publisher that's getting paid, and how much tax occurs in between those two. It's a completely pure digital transaction, but it's incredibly murky and unnecessarily so, because the sort of the tax for the ad tax in the middle is significant. And so, yeah, we were looking to solve a problem of using blockchain technology, which never was quite there, to connect advertisers and publishers directly. Cool concept. I think it's still going to exist. We didn't nail it.
Yeah. And I think that seems to be the common trend with a lot of the tech on the blockchain side. It's like,
yeah,
a lot of possibility, but yeah, execution is challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, and it's such a, I find it incredibly, it's the polar opposite with AI right now. Like in terms of like, it's like, it's working now.
Right.
And the possibilities are real, and you're seeing them in terms of what can be achieved there. I think similar people were involved at both, because it's like, you know, those that have the sort of bright shiny object or like sort of really interested in new technology. I think I've sort of drifted between some of the same sort of trends, but this one's different.
Yeah. Well, and I think also the criticism of crypto and that market is like, everyone wanted to find use cases. It was so difficult to find real like use cases where like, okay, that makes sense in the context of business. Like, and it was always like, well, if it could work, or maybe, and it was never like definitive, like, yes, this is a use case that's better than the alternatives. And with AI, like, we see use cases every single day, like hundreds of thousands of use cases, or like the possibilities are endless. So let's talk about that. So how did you, when did you start figuring out that AI was going to be a serious thing? And then what kind of led into what you created?
Yeah. So kind of like going back to like that original sort of thread of like, it's like building a portfolio of sites, building extra capacity, launching a services business off the back of that extra capacity. So we had a content agency from 2016, sold it in 2022. And we had started to see, the rise of Jasper off the back of GPT-3. I think like those of us that are listening to this podcast, you know, generative AI existed long before ChatGPT. But for a lot of people, it's like generative AI didn't exist until ChatGPT. And so we'd seen it coming. We'd been testing it within one part of the services side of the content agency. And so we were always like, you know, trying to operate, or, you know, ensuring we were operating from a point of integrity, that how can we say with certainty that our content was human created? And that was getting more and more challenging. We were happy to sell AI generated content to people that understood that that's what they were purchasing, and that they, the, you know, the price reflected that, and, you know, do that in an ethical way with fact checking, et cetera. And so we had seen this sort of AI trend coming, and then struggling to how to ensure there's transparency and integrity between the writer, the agency, and the, ultimately the purchaser of that content. You know, regardless of where you sit on, do I want to use AI content or do I not want to use AI content? You certainly don't want to pay for something that you're not receiving the value of, and who's going to, if you are okay with AI content, who's going to realize the value, the efficiency and the value that is generated as a result of the generative AI process being so much faster than a human writer. And so that's what we saw coming. And then we were started building it. 2022 launched just before ChatGPT launched. And actually the original sort of genesis of originality was plagiarism checkers suck. You know, we all use CopyScape. It hasn't changed since 2002.
No.
ability to use team members, like adding team members is hard. You have to change your password. Like, it's just a really challenging tool to use for content publishers that are operating at any kind of scale. And so that's what we were sort of starting to build, and then added in the AI detection, and then launched the weekend before ChatGPT launched.
Okay. Wow. That makes perfect sense. So let's talk about the development of the product. So you, I'm assuming, because it was prior to ChatGPT, you were messing around with GPT-3, so with the OpenAI API. So how did you, I'm assuming you had to do a massive amount of testing to get the tool to really work well. So what did that kind of process look like? And you don't have to reveal anything proprietary, but just kind of what the process overall looked like.
Yeah, I mean, the simplest way of sort of understanding it is, like, you know, imagine taking, you know, an intelligent person, putting them in a room, a factory, and having two piles of content, AI generated content and human generated content, and they just sit there for years looking at an article and saying, I think it's AI, and then checking the backside, oh no, it's human. It's like, oh, okay. And then, like, trying to start recognizing the patterns between the two piles. So that's sort of like how our AI works, is we just feed it a ton of AI generated content, a ton of human generated content, and then it learns to tell the difference between the two. Our first version was not up to where it was better than what was it currently existing. Like, at the point when we launched, there was like GPT, there's a GPT-2 detector. So we trained up on GPT-3. When 3.5 launched in ChatGPT, we were okay, but we were really strong before that, sort of that new iteration. And then, so when we launched, and then ChatGPT launched, we were okay on it, but not nearly as good as we were on raw GPT-3 or GPT-2, which is what we had trained on. And then we had to quickly get caught up. And we got caught up by sort of March was when we launched sort of our version that sort of started to hit that sort of 99% accuracy on GPT-4, 1.5 to 3% false positive rate on sort of website generated content that hadn't been touched by AI.
Okay. Yeah. So one obvious question to me is, how are you going to keep up with the new versions that are going to come? I mean, obviously over time, it's going to get better. It's going to get better. It's seeming more like a human. So how are you going to, I mean, obviously it's not an easy task. So how are you going to handle that, at least to best your ability?
I think there's uncertainty right now on will it get, like, I think there's a scenario where it doesn't get better. There's like, it continues to get better, but there will be a limit that it might hit when the data sets that it can continue to train on are exhausted. Like, it is, AI at this point has basically crawled all of the content that is all human generated content that is worth crawling. Models will still get better, but will, you know, the OpenAI has come out and said, like, hey, the path to future models is not to go bigger, but it's to add more controls, multimodal. And so I think there's a scenario on, you know, it's like right now we're in this ridiculous curve of like, holy crap, it's getting incredibly better. I don't think that curve is going to extend out linearly forever. I think there was going to be, you know, it's a bit of a wave of when we're going to have these troughs and growth. And, you know, there is a risk around sort of model collapse if the majority of generated content becomes AI. You know, we've seen some declining performance out of ChatGPT. So I think there's that scenario, which it may, and then there's also the scenario of like, yeah, it's just going to get so much better that like a GPT, when GPT-10 comes out, you're going to be able to ask it anything, and it's going to tune it to however you want it to be asked. Like write an entire novel like Stephen King, related to an SEO podcast. Done. And so I don't know. So how do we stay up on it? Every model that comes out, we quickly evaluate our performance against it, build a data set to identify how to train our model on it. And then we have a sort of an internal red team that is constantly looking at adversarial ways to bypass our detector, and then building data sets off of that adversarial method, sort of building the adversarial, it's like finding a hack to bypass us, and then evaluating if the quality of that content is high enough that it's like, you know, you can add in a bunch of characters and remove all punctuation, and it will return a incorrect result, but not really a useful use case for the majority of our users. And so we have sort of our red team operating, looking at constantly building adversarial data sets.
Man, yeah, a lot to unpack there. Obviously, yeah. I would love to ask one question, and I know you can't say a lot, right? I know you can't say a lot about the internal workings of detection, okay? And I know there's a lot of people out there that are, let's say they want to beat it. their goal in life is to beat your tool, yep. Right? Like, they, yeah. And fun. For me, you know, for me, I think it's kind of just a kind of weird thing to do anyway. I mean, Google's basically said that if the content's high quality, you know, so, and of course, yep. It's hard to take, you know, Google's words with,
right.
A lot of security. So, let's talk about the SEO side of this equation, which is, how do you feel about AI generated content? And do you feel that if it comes back from your tool, that it's 100% AI generated within that certainty, do you think that's riskier or it doesn't matter?
Yeah, I think so I'm making both decisions in some of my sites. Some of my sites are AI generated content with a human review. And I'm happy to use that content. In that case, I use originality to say, like, if it comes back at 100%, like, I just want to see some sense that, like, okay, that some, you have done some work to fact check this, to verify it, to ensure it's decent quality. So we don't apply a really hard rule around that. And we certainly don't try and like AI content and then beat originality and then publish it. We don't want to sort of force that level of, reworking for the sake of beating a tool that isn't Google. I think that in that world, like, it doesn't make sense to use originality in that sense. And then on some other sites, I'm like, this site is too important. You know, do we believe Google? You know, you can pile up statements on what Google has said and make it sound like they are fully supportive of AI. And you can also then look at data that, you know, they are blocked AdSense sites because of AI generated content. You know, there's signs that Google is not necessarily exactly executing consistent with some of their statements. And so I do think there is risk. So I think this game is like the SEO game is a lot about risk management and identifying what levers you can pull that don't massively disproportionately increase your risk relative to the increase that you're achieving. And I think AI is one of those levers that I can't imagine a world where that AI generated content is not riskier than human generated content in the eyes of Google. It just, you know, the mental knots that you need to tie yourself into to justify that is high. You know, would you rather read a review from Google from an AI or from a human? I think that answers human.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's hard to see people on social media. You know, here's how I created 5 billion articles in 24 hours. And it's right. Like, oh, that's not going to work well for very long, you know, because it's like, you know, anyone that says that, and this is why back to what we were talking about earlier, right, with the being through many cycles. When you haven't been through many cycles, you haven't felt the pain.
Right? Yeah.
And like, I think a lot of us who've been in the SEO industry for a long time have a lot of scar tissue from just what's happened in the past. Yeah. And so for me, like, I don't like, for example, I have plenty of pages that are 100% AI that rank. It works. Yep. It's not a question 100%. Of whether it works or not, right? That's not the question. The question is, will it continue to work and will you get wrecked eventually? And at what level does that risk start to become so intense that you're starting to risk your entire business model, right? And that becomes a dangerous game. So obviously everyone can decide what their own level of risk is. I want to talk about one thing, which is, you know, the actual percentages that you guys use on originality.ai. So I think a lot of people misinterpret those percentages. So can you kind of just clarify how that works and really how to interpret it the right way, and then how to practically use it? Yeah.
So big time. It's one of the, like, we try and communicate it as much as we can, but it's one of the most commonly misunderstood sort of concepts. So all AI is a prediction engine. And so, you know, even ChatGPT is predicting what the next word is that it should produce. And so when you think about AI as a prediction engine, and we are an AI, originality.ai, it has its own AI that predicts whether or not content was AI generated or human generated. And so if it returns a 90% probability that it was original, 10% probability it was AI, it doesn't mean that it was that the AI thinks that this article was 10% AI and 90% original written. It means that there's a 90% confidence that this article was original and human written. And so, yes, it can be very frustrating for people when they have written an article, and then, you know, they'll say, "Hey, you just gave me a false positive. You said there's a 40% that 40% of my article is AI and 60% only 60% of it's human." It's like, we know that's upsetting when it comes back at not 100% human, which, you know, it is. So that's the way, the correct way of interpreting it is, if it's 60% original, 40% AI, then the tool thinks with a 60% probability that was a human written article and a 40% chance that it was an AI written article.
Right. So it's just the probability that it's AI generated.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm glad you clarified that, because I think that a lot of people get that confused. They're like, no, this is not right.
I get it. Right. It's like, I write, like, I've felt it too, where I've like written something and like just for fun, thrown it in. And it's like, man, why do you think that was 25% AI? Like, this is BS.
Yeah. And I mean, so any tool, any SaaS tool, any tool that we use is not perfect, right? It's just the case. Nothing in this world is perfect. No business is perfect. No tool is perfect. I will say, though, I have extensively tested your tool and it is very accurate. I have run pure AI. I've run partial AI. I've run just my own copywriting. Very rarely does my own copywriting come back as AI. Like, very, very rarely. I mean, because it's me. Like, it can't. And so I obviously, you don't need to get into the technical side of like how it knows that. But why? So I guess the biggest question, okay, is, let's say I invest my time. I write the article myself. I throw it in originality and it tells me it's a 50% probability that it's AI. Why does that happen?
Yeah. So here's the, so I agreed. There are times where I've used it where it's like, it has that moment of like, how did you know? It's kind of a crazy. And so the sort of like the bit of the mind screw with you is that, we don't know. You know, the same way that when like AIs that have been developed end up with emergent properties, like they learn a different language when that wasn't necessarily what they were being trained to learn. You can, so yeah, the short answer is we don't know. It recognizes patterns and then we evaluate and test the accuracy on known data sets of known AI to evaluate its effectiveness at what it learned. But you know, if it was as simple as, oh, there's this frequency of this type of punctuation or this stylized, that used to work on like GPT-2 detectors. And so there's like these bag of words detectors where it's like, hey, we're looking for this level of perplexity or this level of burstiness. I call those sort of like bag of word detectors. They don't work on the latest LLMs because you can ask a GPT-4 to say, you know, write a blog post in the style of Dave Chappelle about SEO. And it will do that in a style that doesn't match, you know, what would typically be expected. And then you can also ask it to write, you know, a breakdown of some technical concept for a science conference, and it will do it in that style. And so the range of the type of content that it can now produce is such that these sort of like bag of word detectors are rule based. You know, if these words exist, then it is likely AI. That no longer works. And so the sort of patterns that our model can recognize, we can't say with certainty. We can, there's some sort of common situations that will reduce the accuracy. So like oddly formatted content will reduce the accuracy, won't necessarily increase the false positive or increase the accuracy. Like it's just, it will reduce the accuracy because it's not the type of content that the model has been trained on. So there's, we can communicate, we understand what the type of content that reduces accuracy, but we can't say, yep, this got hit at 60% chance of AI, and here's why. We don't know.
Wow, that's super cool and scary at the same time.
I
So, it's just, oh man, that's really crazy.
So we trained it on, so we built it for English. We trained it on English, and then we had a bunch of people writing us and like, hey, like, can we use like, can we get access to the API? And we're like, oh, we see you, like it only works in English. And they're like, are you sure? Because we just tested it and it's great in German. So it's like the AI's ability to learn things that, even though we only trained our AI exclusively on English content at the start, we have multi-language now, but it learned to recognize patterns that stay fairly consistent or accuracy drop, but on other languages, which was one of those like, huh?
Yeah, that's insane. Yeah, so, you know, one thing that's funny too is because describing how, you know, because with GPT-4 you can really start to change the tonality of the content. You can really make it your own and personal, make it more personable. And like GPT-4 is amazing. Like it just really is. But even then, even if you run like you run a prompt, you have it write some copy, and then you try to use your little techniques with the GPT-4 to get it to be more like a human, it's still your tool still will catch it. It will still catch it. Which is amazing. So I want to talk more about like the actual mind behind this thing, the AI that you're creating here. So you actually built an AI from scratch, is that correct?
No, so almost all AI, it's like saying we built a website from scratch using WordPress.
Right.
So yes, built it like it's our own AI on our own servers that are very expensive. But it's built. So it's a model that there are multiple models that exist out there that are sort of often used to build supervised learning AI. We use a couple of those models, and so it's this sort of mesh of multiple AIs to sort of make sure that we don't have any of these sort of adversarial data sets. Like if we find an adversarial data set that our model can't quite get to, we'll build a separate AI just to sort of attack that adversarial data set. And so it is a combination of, it is sort of one core AI with a combination of other AIs, all reviewing content to make sure it's to give the best probability of if it thinks it's human generated or AI generated.
Right. So are you on the back end feeding your own inputs, or are you actually using the inputs from your tool to train the AI?
So we have the ability for people to, so the primary model of training is our own data sets that we have created or sourced. We have the ability to use customer submitted, but we also have the ability for them to opt out of that training. So they can delete all content. They can opt out of their content being used for future training. It's predominantly used, the majority of the use, the training data that goes into it is data sets that we have created. You will use people who allow their data to be used to help influence the type of data that we go in and find. So it's generally not that we're using hey, Nathan submitted these articles. Those articles have now gone into the training, but these are the types of articles that our customers want to be using this tool for. And we will go get data sets that most closely reflect the type of content that is our tool is being used for.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So tell me more about, because obviously to be able to process this much data, to be able to analyze this much data, to be able to organize this much data, like you must have really built some good infrastructure. So what does your team look like right now for this?
Yeah. So we're at about 15 people now. There's sort of a AI research team that has sort of the red team underneath them, and then sort of the multi-language team and then the lead researcher building the core model. And then we have our sort of back-end infrastructure team. And yeah, the quantities of words scanned and like those things just become meaningless at the site. Like, you know, they become hard numbers to comprehend.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah. So I want to talk more about the business model of RidgeLA.ai. So you have kind of like a credit system, and then you have a monthly subscription as well, correct?
Yep. Correct.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. So as much as you can reveal, how are you managing? Like, I'm sure you have to put a cap on how much people can use or how much it can process. So like, how are you managing that?
Yeah, it's a fascinating problem. In terms of, we have users that, you know, the same as I was when I was a student, but we have students that, you know, we have students from every country in the world using this tool. And then we have some of the most valuable companies in the world using this tool. And so it's this like absurd range of the type of companies that are using it. And then there's some people that want to scan one article, and some people that want to scan 50 million words a month. And how do you sort of manage for all of that? And so I don't know if we've done a great job at this, but credits is sort of using a credit-based system, and then sort of putting in a small subscription that is a good fit for the majority of our users. Sort of like we looked at how most people are using our tool, and then we built a sort of a subscription offering that gives users a little bit of extra value that are consistent users that are using it in the right sort of, or not the right, but using it, a subscription offering that would capture the most users and provide them a little bit of an advantage in terms of a discount on their usage per month. So that was how we built it. And then there's a credit usage, so scales with people that want to run, 50 million plus words a month.
So how are you able to process like the amount of resources you need to be able to process all of that? Well, how are you doing that?
Yeah. It's kind of the beauty of SaaS in terms of the scalability of it. It's not without pain, but, we have constantly increasing server sizes, to sort of be able to handle it. An AWS bill that is terrifying.
I'm sure.
There's a server that we use as our training server that's $15,000 a month. And it's just like one of those things where it's like, that's like three nice houses a month. Like, right. Like how big is a server? Anyway, bit of a mess with your mind when you think about it. It's the beauty of SaaS, where you can have fairly significant scalability, again, not without its challenges, but just sort of like resourcing up on the servers. You know, the beauty of what AWS and why that's become such an incredible business model for Amazon. But yeah, it's just sort of like, okay, we're hitting limits, scale up, alerts to know when we need to scale up. And that's I mean, if the sort of DevOps team was here, they'd kick me for making it sound too simple.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think people think it's super much more complicated than it actually is in some cases. Like when people hear about servers and data centers, like, oh my gosh, I have to build a data center.
Right.
But it's not like that. Like,
no.
So it's a more technical version of upgrading your hosting in some ways.
Exactly. Great analogy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good to know. Okay. So, let's talk about, cause you mentioned that you do have some enterprise level clients. So, so you're obviously you're attracting a lot. You're like, have you really decided at this point who your ideal client is? Okay. So what does that look like?
Yeah. So our background, so content publishers, not students, you know, when this came out, there's a ton of demand from academia. We still have a ton of users from academia. The sort of, it's a probability machine. That is, we can accurately communicate the accuracy rate. We know there are false positives. If you have a school with 40,000 students submitting 10 articles a month, and you try and achieve a sort of a disciplinary level of confidence, it's just not possible with an AI detector alone. So we don't love the use case within academia and specifically call that out. Our core users are web publishers. It's the background that we understand. We can build features that benefit that user base, content teams and web publishers, copy editors, sort of any tool that we can build to make their life easier. In that stage of you've received a piece of content, you now need to run it through a QA/QC process. We sit there helping with the QA/QC process of a piece of content before it gets published on the web.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's really fascinating to see how kind of you've progressed over the years, but you've stayed pretty consistent in your lane of what you really specialize in. So like for other entrepreneurs who are listening to this, like how important is that to, because I think people get really scared when they think that they have to kind of stay in their lane. Right. I think that can be kind of a scare. No, I want to go after this and that. And because that's entrepreneurial, it's the curse, right? It's the curse.
100%.
So how do you stay focused and really focus on the thing that you're good at and do that? You've done it consistently for a long time.
Yeah. And it's like the projects that you're aware of, that's true on, because those are the ones that were ultimately successful. There's other projects out there that was not the case, and they sucked, and they attracted three customers. I think, you know, any time where I've certainly launched projects that I have no business launching, and they have failed, and that's when I don't have a deep understanding of the problem of the customer, have no unfair advantage to the first few customers. That's, you know, I think, you know, what's worked well with originality with some of the other projects, like the content marketing business, is deep understanding of the problem, some kind of unfair advantage on acquisition of the first customers, where it's okay, we've got an unfair advantage, but like a network that anyone else could achieve, but an existing audience. Those projects have always been far more successful than a project that was in a different field that I had thought I had some clever insight into, which might be true, but didn't have any sort of ability to deeply understand the details behind the problem. And we're seeing that with other AI detectors right now that, you know, have launched with potentially a stronger academic background around AI detection, but a far weaker understanding of the content publishing world and the problem set that is being addressed. And they're sort of they're struggling both on the detecting side and on the feature side and the sort of penetration of the market compared to what we're doing, because we understand them. And so I think always the case is to build some kind of core competency that can be a consistent thread through whatever your journey looks like.
Yeah, it's really difficult to bridge that gap when it comes to nuance. Like it's much easier just to kind of stay within the same kind of topic instead of trying to, like, if you decide to start selling shoes, you could probably do okay, but like it would be hard. Very, very difficult. Barrier to entry would be very hard. So let's talk about how you manage all of this. Cause obviously, you know, you're quite the entrepreneur. You've put out a lot of projects, you've tried a lot of things. So how are you able to manage it all?
Yeah. So, there's some sort of like call it team infrastructure around, like, so you probably, you know, it's a popular book, but the book Traction, gets talked about a lot. So just sort of, there's a certain cadence to the team. I try and make sure that I'm not the CEO. I've kind of screwed that one up on originality, but sort of in any project I launch, I try and make sure I get myself out of that seat as fast as possible. And so we use sort of the framework within Traction with a couple tweaks. We like the OKR, the objectives and key results for goal setting. So it's just like daily stand up, weekly one-on-one with each team member, quarterly goal setting, and then it all sort of wrapped up around the sort of operating framework from Traction. And yeah, trying to sort of maintain that combination of sort of like real nitty gritty discipline around the operational side allows for this sort of like freewheeling chaos of launching new stuff. And it's probably one of the bigger challenges with sort of the style that I have of the different projects, but I can't neglect that sort of core operational infrastructure.
The boring stuff.
But if I the boring stuff, yeah. But if I only focus on that, then there's no sort of new creative destruction occurring, and that's really where like the Traction book talks about the visionary and the integrator. And I don't have it all sort of worked out. We've had plenty of failed projects and probably doing more than I should, and instead of focusing on a couple of the kind of the keys, but it's all fun, and unless someone tells me to stop, I'll keep doing it.
Yeah. So I want to go circle back to the enterprise level clients. So so are those clients just coming in organically and naturally, and they're finding it, they're liking it, then they're pitching that to their superiors, or you do have like a sales process in place where you're building that out?
Yeah, so a bit of both. We have a fairly heavy cold outreach machine that's running, that's targeting mostly our ICP, like mostly our kind of ideal customer that we just talked about. And then we have a lot of them coming to us. You know, if they have a problem related to AI detection and they go online and search for it, there's you know, a ton of tools, but only so many that are sort of like clearly sort of executing at a sort of an enterprise level. And so we get a lot of outreach from companies. That's a learning curve. Like there's security audit processes that are necessary. There's external audit steps that we should be completing, and we're working our way to getting completed. But that's how they're currently finding us, is mostly through all of the marketing initiatives that we have running.
Right. Okay. So I guess the last question is, how do you feel about tools that are designed to beat your tool?
Like, I find that fascinating. Yeah, I'd be great.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all a big game, right? We're all playing this game. So it's like nothing against them, but I just interesting that there is a whole side of the business that's based on that.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. So I'm not, you know, I think sometimes people, and probably not the people in this podcast, but if, like, because it's like, you know, I think the sort of the risk based decision making related to SEO is something that all SEOs are used to. But I think sometimes people are really surprised when they're like, wait, you use AI content? Like, we're not against AI content at all. We're just against the a lack of integrity in the use of it. And if I want to use AI content on my website, and I'm making that decision to accept that risk, I want to be the one that captures the value of the increased efficiency. So I'd say I'm definitely not against AI content, and the bypass tools, the quality of the content that they produce is kind of not there, because they right now the majority of the tactics to bypass detectors is a bunch of sort of grammatical changes that make it so it's like if you use one of the bypass tools and then you correct it with Grammarly, it's detectable again.
Right, because Grammarly uses AI.
Yes. And even if you use a non AI, even if you used a human editor to just fix the grammar, it will then become detectable again. And so it's like sort of like injecting the minimal number of errors possible to make it undetectable, but through the method of injecting errors
it's such a backwards way of thinking of things.
Yeah. And so I'd say like tools, like fair use, great. The use case of those tools, like, you know, I'd say I have a challenge with if a writer tells me that they're not using AI and then they use a tool to trick the tool that I'm attempting to trick the tool that I'm using to check that they didn't use AI, you know, that there's a lack of integrity in that experience and a lack of transparency that I don't like. So, the tools themselves, I don't know. I got no problem with it. It's a fun game.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of the tools make the content worse to pass the AI detection. So right. Like what goal did we achieve by doing that? You know, so it doesn't. Right. Yeah. So it is a very odd thing. So so how, you know, obviously people know about your tool. What are some other ways people can connect with you, talk to you, and, you know, ultimately become a client of originality.ai?
Yeah, so originality.ai, my contact information's on there. I'm on Twitter a bit, LinkedIn a little bit, but yeah, happy to connect with anyone if they have any questions or any, you know, we're having a lot of fun right now nerding out on running studies about how generative AI is impacting the world, like what's the increased usage of AI within Amazon reviews, within, you know, other sort of questions that we're asking. And so if anyone has any sort of clever ideas for trying to understand how generative AI is impacting the world, we're always eager to be helping to support those studies.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on, John. This was super, super interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks, Haley.